Station here, he told Ralph, and don't move until I do. They moved on down the ravine, while Zuga placed Jan Sharut and Jordan side by side in a bend of the ravine where the bank had collapsed, and formed an easy ramp up which they could launch their charge. Keep Geordie close, Zuga cautioned Jan Sharut, and swung the gelding around with the saddlery creaking as the animal turned in the narrow gut of the ravine. Then Zuga trotted back until he was in the centre of the waiting line, and there he halted and contained his impatience, glancing up repeatedly at the lowering sun. There would probably not be another chance for many days, and each day was vital for those untended claims. Zuga jerked the rifle from the leather bucket on his knee, selected a cartridge from the bandolier around his waist, and slipped it into the breech. Then he returned the weapon uncocked to the bucket. It was merely a precaution, but he had no means of knowing what manner of men those approaching figures were. Even if their intentions were peaceable, and their ultimate object identical to Zuga's own, yet they would be armed and nervous, so nervous that they had avoided the road from the north and were travelling over the open veldt. They were in company for defence, and Zuga knew that they would have been harassed often along the way by black men and white. The black men trying to rob and cheat them of their meagre possessions, the white men of something infinitely more valuable, their right to contract their labour to the highest bidder. On the day that Zuga thanked Neville Pickering for his tuition and began preparing to work the Devil's Own claims for his personal account, he had faced the problem that was already racking the entire subcontinent. Only black men could stand the conditions of physical labour in the diggings. Only black men would work for a wage that made the diggings profitable. And even that beggarly wage was many times more than the Boer farmers of the surrounding backveld republics could afford to pay. The diamond diggings had denuded the countryside of labourers for 500 miles around, and the Boers resented that as fiercely as they resented the nest of adventurers and fortune-seekers that the diggings supported. The diamonds had caused an upheaval in the Boers' traditional way of life. Not only were the miners threatening the supply of cheap labour, which only just allowed a diligent and frugal farmer to eke out a living for himself and his family from the savage land, but the diggers were doing something else that from the Boer point of view was unforgivable, that went against all their deeply held beliefs and threatened not just their livelihood, but their very physical existence. The diamond diggers were paying the black tribesmen with guns. The Boers had fought the tribes at Blood River and Mosega. They had stood to the laager in 10,000 threatening dawns, the favourite hour of attack. They had seen the smoke rising from their burning homesteads and crops. They had ridden out on commando, on the spoor of their stolen herds. And they had buried the pale corpses of their children, the blood drained from the frail bodies through the gaping and terrible wounds of the assegai. They had buried them at Weenan, the place of weeping, and at other accursed and abandoned gravesites across the land. The payment of black men with guns went against every one of their instincts. It flew full in the face of their laws and offended the memories of their dead heroes. For these reasons, Boer commandos from the little backveld republics were sweeping the land and patrolling the lonely roads from the north to try and prevent the tribesmen reaching the diggings and instead press them to work upon the land. However, 5 shillings a week and a musket at the end of a 3 years' contract were a lure that brought the tribesmen on foot against 100 hazards on a journey of hundreds of miles, daring the commandos and all else to reach the diggings. They came in their hundreds, but still not enough of them arrived to fill those hungry diamond pits. In vain Zuga and Jan Sharut had ridden the workings. Every black man was signed on contract and jealously guarded by his employer. Zuga had told Jan Sharut, "We'll offer 7 shillings and sixpence a week." They signed 5 men that same day at the higher wage, and the next day there were 12 deserters waiting outside Zuga's camp, eager for the new coin. Before Zuga could sign them, Neville Pickering sauntered up. "Official visit, old man," he murmured apologetically. "As a member of the Jolly Old Diggers Committee, I have to tell you that the rate is 5 shillings, not 7 and 6. When Zuga opened his mouth to protest, Pickering smiled easily and held up his hand. "No, Major, I'm sorry. It's 5 shillings, and not a penny more." Zuga was already in no doubt about the sweeping powers of the Diggers Committee. An edict from the elected body was enforced firstly by a warning, then a beating, and finally by the full aggression of the entire community of diggers, which could end in a burning or even a lynching. "What do I do for a gang, then?" Zuka demanded. "You do what we all do. You go out and find a gang before another digger or a Boer commando grabs them." "But I might have to go as far north as the Shashi River," Zuka snapped sarcastically. And Pickering nodded in agreement. "Yes, you might." Zuka smiled thinly at the memory of his first lesson in digger labour relations. And now he settled his hat firmly and gathered up his reins. "All right," he muttered. "Let's go recruiting." And he put his heels into the gelding's flanks and went lunging up the bank of the ravine onto the open plain. The tribesmen were 500 yards dead ahead, and he counted swiftly, 16 of them. If he could take them all, he could start back for New Rush in tomorrow's dawn. 16 men were sufficient to work the Devil's Own, and at that moment they had, for Zuka, the same value as a 50-carat diamond. They were in single file, moving swiftly, the trotting gait of the fighting impis of Zulu, no women or children with them. "Good," grunted Zuka, as the gelding stretched out under him. And he held him back in an easy canter as he glanced right. Jan Sherut was tearing across the plain, Jordan plugging along in his dust 50 strides behind. At this distance, Jordan did not look like a child. They might have been a pair of armed riders, and Jan Sherut was swinging wide, trying to get behind the little group of men, pinning them before they scattered, pinning them long enough for Zuka to get within hail. Zuka glanced left and scowled as he saw that Ralph was at full gallop, leaning low over his horse's neck, brandishing the Martini Henry rifle. And Zuka hoped it was still unloaded, wished that he had specially ordered Ralph not to show the rifle. And yet even in that moment of anger he experienced a little prickle of pride as he watched his son ride. The boy was born to the saddle. Zuka checked the gelding again, bringing him down to a trot, giving his flank men time to complete the circle, and at the same time trying to reduce the dramatic effect of his approach. He knew that they would appear to the tribesmen to be an armed commando, their intentions warlike, and he tried to soften this by lifting his hat and waving it over his head. Then suddenly Jan Sherut was reining in, gesturing to Jordan to do the same. They had got behind the band and opposite them, facing them across the wide circle. Ralph was wheeling his filly and bringing her up sharply on her hind legs, rearing and shaking out her mane theatrically. In the centre, the tribesmen had moved swiftly, and with the concerted action of trained fighting men. They had dropped the rolled bundles of sleeping mat, cooking pot, and leather grain bag that they had been carrying on their heads, and they had bunched into a defensive circle, shoulder to shoulder, war shield overlapping war shield, while above them the steel of their assegais flicked little pinpricks of sunlight. They did not wear the full regalia of their fighting regiments, the kilts of monkey tails, the cloaks of desert fox furs, the tall headdress of ostrich and widow bird feathers. They were travelling with weapons only, but the shields they presented to the approaching horsemen and the glint of steel told Zuka all he needed to know. The shields gave the tribe its name, the Matabili, the people of the long shields. The little group of men who stood impassively in the sunlight and watched Zuka ride up were the finest warriors that Africa had ever spawned, yet they were almost 500 miles south of the borders of Matabili land. "I set for a covey of partridge," Zuka smiled to himself, "and I have trapped a brood of eagles." 100 yards from the ring of shields, Zuka reined in. But the gelding, infected by the tension, fidgeted under him. The long shields were made of dappled black and white oxhide. Every regiment of the Matabili carried a distinctive shield. Zuka knew that black dappled with white was the regimental colour of the Inyati, the Buffalo's regiment, and again he felt a twist of nostalgia. Once the Induna who commanded the Inyati had been a friend. They had travelled together across the mimosa-clad plains of Matabili land. They had hunted together and shared the comfort of the same campfires. It was all so long ago, on his first visit to the land below the Zambezi River. But Zuka was carried back so vividly that it required an effort of will to shake off the memory. He lifted his right hand, fingers spread in the universal gesture of goodwill. "Warriors of Matabili, I see you," he called to them, speaking their language as fluently as one of them, the words returning to his tongue readily. He saw the small stir behind the war shields, the shift of heads with which they greeted his words. "Jordan," Zuga called, and the child circled out and reined in his pony at Zuga's side. Now the difference in size between man and boy was apparent. "See, warriors of King Lobengula, my son rides with me." No man took his children to war. The ring of shields sank a few inches, so Zuga could see the dark and watchful eyes of the men behind them. But as Zuga pushed the gelding a few paces forward, the shields were immediately lifted again defensively. "What news of Gandang, Induna of the Inyati regiment? Gandang, who is as my brother," Zuga called again, persuasively. At the mention of the name, one of the warriors could no longer contain himself, swept aside his shield, and stepped from the ring of spears. "Who calls Gandang brother?" he demanded in a clear, firm voice. A young voice, yet with the timbre and inflection of one used to authority. "I am Bakela, the Fist," Zuga gave his Matabili name, and he realized that the warrior facing him was still a youth, barely older than Ralph. But he was lean and straight, narrow in the hips, and with muscle in the shoulder and arms built up in the games of war. Zuga guessed he had probably already killed his man, washed his spear in blood. Now he crossed the open ground towards Zuga, his stride lithe, his legs long and shapely beneath the short leather kilt. "Bakela," he said, as he stopped a dozen paces from the gelding's head. "Bakela." He smiled, a brilliant show of white, even teeth in the broad and handsome Nguni face. "That is a name I took with the first draught of my mother's milk, for I am Batso, the axe, son of the same Gandang whom you call brother, and who remembers you as an old and trusted friend. I know you by the scar on your cheek and the gold in your beard. I greet you, Bakela." Zuga swung down off the gelding, leaving the rifle in the saddle scabbard, and grinning broadly, went to clasp the youth's upper arms in an affectionate salute. Then, turning with his fists on his hips, still smiling, Zuga shouted to Ralph, "Go and see if you can shoot a springbuck, or better even a wildebeest. We'll need plenty of meat for tonight." Ralph let out a whoop at the command, and provoked the filly with his heels, forcing her to rear again and then come down in full run, mane flying, hooves pounding, as she bore away. Without being ordered, Yan Shurut shook his bony mare into a canter and followed the flying filly. The two riders returned in the dusk, and the hunt had gone well. They had found rare quarry, a bull eland so old that his neck and shoulders had turned blue with age, and the swinging dewlap almost swept the dusty earth between his stubby forelegs. He was as big as a prize stud bull, with a chest round as a brandy cask of Limousin oak, and Zuga guessed he would weigh not much under a ton, for he was fat and sleek. There would be a tub full of rich white lard in the chest cavity, and thick layers of yellow fat beneath the glossy hide. He was a prize indeed, and the little band of Matabili drummed their assegai against the hide shields and shouted with delight when they saw him. The bulls snorted at the hubbub and broke into a lumbering gallop, trying to break away. But Ralph swung the filly to head him off, and within a few hundred yards the bull changed the gallop for a short-winded trot and allowed himself to be turned back towards the group of waiting men. Ralph reined in the filly, kicked his feet from the stirrups, and jumped easily to the earth, throwing up the carbine as he landed cat-like on his toes and seeming to fire in the same instant. The bull's head flinched at the shot, blinking the huge shining eyes convulsively as the bullet slammed into his skull between them, and he collapsed with a meaty thud that seemed to tremble in the earth. The Matabili streamed out like a pack of wild dogs, swarming over the mountainous carcass, using the razor edge of their war assegai, as butcher's knives, going for the titbits, the tripes and the liver, the heart and the sweet white fat. The Matabele gorged on fat eland meat, grilling the tripes over the coals, threading garlands of liver and fat and succulent heart onto wet white mimosa twigs, from which they had peeled the bark, so that the melting fat sizzled and bubbled over the layers of meat. "We have killed no game since we left the forests," Batso explained their ravenous appetites. Though the desert teemed with springbuck herds, they were not the type of game that a man on foot armed only with a stabbing spear could run down easily. "Without meat, a man's belly is like a war drum, full of nothing except noise and wind." "You are far from the land of the Matabele," Zuga agreed. "No Matabele has been this far south since the old king took the tribe north across the Limpopo, and in that time even Gundung, your father, was a child." "We are the first to make this journey," Batso agreed proudly. "We are the point of the spear." In the firelight, the warriors about him looked up, and their expressions echoed his pride in their achievement. They were all youths, the eldest only a few years older than Batso, not one of them over 19 years of age. "Where does this long journey take you?" Zuga asked.
"To a wonderful place in the south from which a man returns with great treasures."
"What manner of treasures?" Zuga asked again.
"These."
Batso reached across the circle to where Ralph leaned against his saddle, using it as a pillow, and Batso touched the polished wooden butt of the Martini Henry that protruded from the gun bucket.
"Isi bamu, guns," said Batso.
"Guns?" Zuga asked.
"A Matabele in Dodder with a gun?"
His voice mildly derisive.
"Is not the assegai the weapon of the true warrior?"
Batso looked uncomfortable for a moment and then recovered his aplomb.
"Ah, the old ways are not always the best," he said. "The old men tell us that they are, so that young men will consider them wise."
And the Matabele in the circle about the fire nodded and made little sounds of agreement. Although he was certainly the youngest of the group, Batso was clearly their leader. Son of Gundung, he was therefore the nephew of King Lobengula, grandson of old King Mzilikazi himself. His noble birth assured him preference, but it was clear that he was quick and clever also. "To earn the guns you covet, a man must work hard in a deep pit in the earth," Zuga said. "He must milk himself of his sweat by the calabashful every day for 3 years before he is paid with a gun."
"We have had these things," Batso nodded. "Then you shall have your guns. Each of you a fine gun at the end of 3 years. I, Bakela the Fist, give you my word on it."
It was a custom of the diggings, a ceremony of initiation, that when a gang of raw tribesmen arrived at New Rush, the established black labourers would rush to line each side of the track, most of them dressed in cast-off European finery as a badge of their sophistication. They would jeer their newly arrived brethren.
"Behold, the baboons come down from the hills."
"Nay, baboons are cunning. These cannot be baboons."
And they pelted the newcomers with pieces of filth as well as insults. Batso's group were the first Matabele to reach the diggings. The Matabele language is almost identical to that of Zululand, and very closely associated to the southern Xhosa. Batso understood every word of the banter, and he gave a quiet but grim order to his little group. His men dropped their sleeping mats, and the long shields rattled one against the other. The broad, bright assegais whispered in the sunlight as they were bared, and the taunts and derisive laughter dried on the instant to be replaced with expressions of astonishment and real dismay.
"Manje, now," hissed Batso.
The ring of shields exploded outwards, and the crowd fled before it in disordered panic.